He says, I didn't like the idea of what was going on. I never wanted it to happen. I wanted to be a normal teenager. You have uncovered my darkest secret that I have been trying to forget about for a very long time. I've been having sick nightmares. I was a robot during that. I was told what to do and what to say. This would ruin and haunt me for life if this went public. I have nothing to live for. I want it to stop and go back to normal. I didn't want to lie. I hate lying. I hate all of this. If I told anyone, they would send me away. They did. Why did you tell? I'm scared to death. I don't want to be on the news. I'm sick all the time. The fear of facing my parents is unbearable. I've lost all those things that are closest to my heart. I'm ashamed of myself. I spiral into depression daily. I will be looked at as even more a freak. More a black sheep. We don't have to guess about what these kids go through. We just have to listen to them.
This is Infants on Thrones. Philosophies of men mingled with humans. We are the Quorum.
Welcome back to Infants on Thrones. I'm Glenn Ostlund, and today you're going to hear another Wednesday Night Live presentation, this time from our very own Matt Long, who is as good tonight as I have ever seen him. This is Matt Long, the trial attorney. Not a wolf in sheep's clothing, per se, but maybe a sheep in wolf's clothing, a tenaciously compassionate bulldog of a teacher and healer in sex crimes prosecutor clothing, carefully educating a jury, building a compelling argument, addressing the worst parts of our shared human existence with a tender boldness, a fearless clarity, and a ferocious love. We're lucky to have Matt in our corner. Now, just to remember to those of you in the Phoenix area that we're holding these live presentations every Wednesday night from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the Community of Christ Chapel in Mesa, Arizona. Now, we're also streaming these live on Facebook, and we'll start doing it on YouTube very soon as well. Please consider joining us if you can. And if you appreciate what we're doing and would like to support our continuing efforts, please join us on Patreon and sign up to support Infants on Thrones for as little as $1 per month. Thank you. And now, Matt Long.
All right. So the heavy topics we're going to be covering today. We are going to be talking about a specific case. We're going to be talking about the interview process. And before we get into the heavy stuff, I was just thinking about just the universe generally, and specifically the sun, and how beautiful the universe can be, and how much creation and good things the sun brings, but that the universe is also chaotic, destructive. Similarly, the sun is also destructive, brings things like cancer and other horrible things. I only bring that up just because as we're focusing and we're going to be talking about so much ugliness in the world and so much destruction, it's just always important for me to remember that good's out there too. And that so often when we talk about these kids and these victims, we view them as sometimes in a certain light. For me, I just think of my kids and the hope that they've given me and the way that they've inspired me as I've seen these kids grow and develop and just become powerful people. So in order to get started, I want to tell you about one of my kids. And before I tell you about one of my kids, I want to apologize to a number of the people who are going to hear this story. And I'm going to apologize because this story may sound very familiar to a lot of people. Because the kid that I'm going to talk about is really every victim. And the thing that he went through, the things that he experienced, many victims experience. But I'm hopeful that as you hear this story, and as some people hear their own story, that there will be healing in hearing similar events, similar things that other people have gone through and go through. As I talk about other people's stories and the experiences that I've seen, you know, it's really not my voice. It's the voice of the victims. It's the voice of these kids. So I'm hopeful that I can give their voice, I guess, the power that it deserves, because it's affected me in my life. So with that too much preamble, I want to tell you about kid name, that I'm not going to say his name. We'll call him, should have had the name ready beforehand. We'll call him Rob. Rob, because I can remember the name because it's my brother's name and other people who I love. So I'll tell you about Rob. Rob met his abuser when he was a little kid. The abuser was a friend of a family and a member of their congregation, of their ward. This offender took an interest in this kid, started showing attention, picked him out as the black sheep of the family, gave him some attention, gifts, showered him with a number of gifts, gave him money, started gaining his trust, and started engaging in grooming behaviors as part of the giving gifts, talking inappropriately, breaking down physical barriers, breaking down appropriate barriers of conversation, talking about sexual things, eventually abusing this kid sexually. The abuse started when he was approximately 14 years old. And that abuse continued. At some point, the relationship was so odd, so skewed, and so overt that Rob's parents and family members thought something's wrong here. So those people who love their kid, they called a meeting with their ecclesiastical leader, and the ecclesiastical leader of the offender. And in 2009, there was a meeting where bishops got together with the families, and there was a conversation about inappropriate gifts, inappropriate attention, and an inappropriate relationship between an older woman and a young man. In that meeting, Rob's father specifically gave back some items that were very expensive, iPods, iPads, these types of things. Gave it back and said, "Take this back. Are you having sex with my son?" In front of the bishops. My goodness, of course not. Why would anyone say that? There was an agreement or a threat that orders of protection would be gotten out, because they wanted their son left alone. All of this happened in front of their ecclesiastical leaders. Well, about a year later, after that meeting, some text messages were found by Rob's girlfriend's mother. And they were text messages, clearly sexual text messages, between Rob and the offender. And from that led to his parents being aware what their greatest fear was, what they likely knew in that meeting from a year ago, that this woman was sexually abusing this boy who was in another ward. Rob goes to his bishop and he tells him about what had been going on for the last 3+ years and how involved the sexual abuse was. What Rob didn't know is that the bishop he was talking to already had that information. The bishop that he went to talk to, his bishop, was already called by the offender's bishop. Because the offender's bishop had a visit within the last couple days from the offender, where she gave a little bit of a disclosure of an inappropriate relationship with a boy in an adjacent ward. And consistent with the church handbook of instructions, the offender's bishop called the victim's bishop and told him. That was the scenario that this kid walked into when he told his bishop about the sexual abuse. An investigation started, and this victim was very fortunate to have a very, very, very good detective. A detective who took the case seriously, and despite the gender issues and despite the power structure, what I didn't say is this offender happened to be the wife of a politician. And despite those issues, he took it seriously and he listened to this kid. And this kid gave us a case study for how abuse occurs generally and where the pitfalls are in institutions such as the Mormon Church. Now, this case is not specific to the Mormon Church. This case happens to have the Mormon Church and the LDS Church as a backdrop, as the stage for this incident. The reason why this case is a good one to look at is because it really demonstrates every case. As we talk about what victims go through, I'm going to be referring to something I referenced in the last presentation, and that's the process of victimization. And it's important to understand, it's important to go through, because it tells us and it gives us some insight into one thing. A number of things, but one thing in particular, to consider the impact on the victim. We'll go through that for a little bit. So the process of victimization is selection, engagement, grooming, assault, and concealment. Okay? So as we're talking about these case studies, now I was going to talk about Rob's story, but it's not a story. It's a case study. It's a case study in what real abuse looks like. And Rob's story is everyone's story. Now, I should say, I'm not using this particular victim's name. I've got permission in the past to do this type of a presentation, to use his name, but because it's being recorded and published, I just chose not to do that. That may change at some point, and a lot of people probably know who I'm talking about. It's a public case that got a lot of attention back in 2010, but I just want that caveat out there. So, as we're going through the story, please consider the impact on the victim and the burdens that victim experience as we're talking about what they have to go through the course of experiencing this process of victimization, keeping it quiet, and then ultimately telling. So I want to think about some of the burdens that kids and victims experience as they've gone through being abused. They've experienced sometimes threats that are both true and threats that are false. If you tell, I'll hurt you. If you tell, they'll take me to jail. If you tell, I'll kill your dog. If you tell, your brothers and sisters are going to be taken to CPS. If you tell, Who's going to pay for food and things? The burdens that these kids are experiencing, the burden of keeping a family together, the burden of thinking it's their responsibility or that they might be the one that sends a loved one to jail or prison, the burden of trying to protect siblings. These are heavy, heavy things that these kids have taken on to themselves. Consider the impact on the victim. And I say false and true because if a disclosure does happen, if a kid does tell, some of the things that they were worried about actually happen. Families are broken up. Loved ones are taken to jail. Kids are sent to CPS. The family finds themselves on the brink of poverty. These things, these fears that existed, are manifest. Consider the impact on these kids. So, when we're talking about any type of a disclosure, a potential disclosure, and today we're going to talk a little bit about mandatory reporting and who mandatory reporters are and who they aren't. And it's important to understand that because when we're talking about mandatory reporting, again, consider the impact on the victim. So, if I say mandatory reporting, who are some mandatory reporters out there in the world that we know about that are commonly referred to? Okay, we got physicians, we've got medical personnel, we've got teachers, educators. Anyone else? Nurses, psychologists, counselors, cops, law enforcement. Okay, we can expand a little further. And most of those are in the course and scope of their job. So if a teacher is outside being a teacher, they're at the mall or something, and they're aware of some kid may be abused, they don't have an obligation to report. They aren't mandatory reporters in that situation. Okay? Other people who are mandatory reporters, folks, parents, people who have the care and custody of kids, okay? Clergy. If you look at that list of people who are mandatory reporters, there seems to be a through line. And it's essentially this. It's those people who, because of their job or their status, are likely to get information about abuse. That's really what we're talking about. Okay? So, for example, a clergy member, there's no course and scope of their job. It's not just in a certain scenario. It's they are mandatory reporters if they learn of abuse. I know. Except there's an exception for clergy members. But I want to talk about these mandatory reporters to understand, again, why the people that are mandatory reporters, and it has to do their position is likely to get some sort of a disclosure or information about abuse. So in talking about disclosures and these things, an important piece to understand is the different types of disclosures. Okay, we've already talked about the burdens that exist with disclosures. And those burdens, I think, educate on why kids are so reluctant to tell, why there's a delayed disclosure that happens. So, how do reports come in? They generally are going to come in one of three different ways, and I'm going to put a fourth one in there that I played with recently. So, the first one is a purposeful, an intentional disclosure. This is a scenario where kid goes to school and possibly a friend discloses, or they have a good touch, bad touch presentation, or they see something on a TV show that they're watching, and it encourages them to tell. And so armed with that information, they go to an adult, a friend, or someone else, and they make a decision. I'm going to stop suffering in silence. And I'm going to get out of this concealment phase that I've been in, this fear and this fear. and I'm going to tell. So based on that, they come forward and they tell teacher, mom, dad, brother, clergyman, whomever, a purposeful, intentional disclosure. Okay? The most rare. The most rare. If that's the most rare, what do you suppose the most common is? If we're not talking about disclosure, not saying anything ever. The most common. There's no report ever. Purposeful, no report ever. There are still kids out there suffering in silence that are still in the concealment phase, that still have yet to tell anybody about the abuse that they experience, and that's the most common reaction. So you also have, other than purposeful, you have a prompted disclosure, okay? That is, someone may see something or feel there's something a little off and try to draw it out. Hey, is anything happening? You know, a parent becomes aware just of the problem and decides they're going to have a conversation with their kid, and they have the good touch, bad touch conversation with the kid. Has anything like this been going on? Prompted. And so then you get the kid, in some cases, willing to tell. Prompted. The most common disclosure, though, happens as accidental. Something is seen, a text message is found, there's just some weird behaviors or observations that are made, and it's revealed. Pictures are found. There's just various ways where someone stumbles onto the abuse. And the thing that the child feared the most, the exposure of this incident, the abuse, comes to light. Accidental disclosure. Those burdens that we talked about have to be considered in conjunction with these types of disclosures, right? Because consider the burdens when these different types of disclosures happen. What these kids must go through when they make a decision to make a disclosure intentionally. What these kids must go through when they're prompted of something and don't expect that they're going to have the conversation that they're going to have. Or when they had no anticipation that anybody knew or would find out, and they're forced to talk about something they weren't prepared to talk about through accommodation, through fear, both real and sometimes imagined. But consider the impact on the victim depending on the type of disclosure that happens. Okay? So here, in Rob's case, we had an accidental disclosure. Something he just didn't want to come out because of the shame, because of the shared responsibility that he felt, and that's part of concealment, something we're going to get into in later discussions. But that's part of the concealment phase, is making kids feel shame and responsible for the act and the acts to keep them quiet. I want to tell you about another one of my kids, Sarah. Sarah was very, very excited because she was about to turn 8. She had her dress. She just got some new scriptures. And she'd been practicing plugging her nose and dropping her knees, or bending her knees, as her brother would guide her down, showing her how easy baptism was going to be. The only thing she had yet to do was talk to her bishop. And it was Sunday, regular Sunday, and she knew that that was going to be a day that she was going to talk to her bishop. She was scared, though. She didn't want to talk to her bishop. She didn't know him real well. So she told her mom before church she didn't want to do it. And what was he going to ask? Really wanted to know, what is he going to ask? She said, oh, he's just going to make sure you're ready for baptism and that you're worthy. But of course you're worthy. You're not even 8 years old, and you can't even sin until you're 8 years old. Sarah felt like she could sin, but she accepted what her mother said, and she went and talked to her bishop. She telling, she went and talked to her bishop, started to have a conversation. He made her laugh, and he was very nice. And he started talking to her about the law of chastity and worthiness, telling her it's an important day, and it's a good time. You know, being baptized is an important step. Talked to her a little bit about, you know, what chastity means and morality, modesty, talking about covering up her naked body. And she told him, you know, I've seen my brother naked once, and he's seen me naked once. And she started to say something else, but the bishop jumped in and said, oh, that's family members see each other naked from time to time. That's not what we're talking about. So she stopped. They talked a little bit more, and she had passed. She was worthy to be baptized. And her brother, who was just turned 16, was going to be able to baptize her. When Sarah was 5 years old, her brother started grooming her. By 7, the abuse had gotten fairly excessive. By 8 years and when she was 8 years old and 3 days, she no longer felt worthy. About the time she was 13, she made a purposeful disclosure to her friend, telling her about the years of abuse that she suffered at her brother's hands. And her friend asked a question, a fair question: have you told anyone? And she said, yeah, my bishop. Because for the last 5 years, she had been having one-on-one interviews with the bishop. And in each of those interviews, she said something about the abuse. But because of a lack of training, a lack of knowledge, he missed it. He missed it. There's a lot of discussion about any interview, but especially the LDS interview. The LDS interview is particularly problematic because these aren't just kids coming and intentionally or purposely talking about things that they want to talk about, like happens in other churches. You have, in some cases, a stranger, but an adult who's prodding, who's asking questions about nakedness, sexuality, and other sexual topics. The LDS interview, personal priesthood interview, the whatever you want to call it, worthiness interview, is effectively a call for victims to disclose. And they're getting disclosures again and again and again. And too often they're mishandling them, they're ignoring them, or just flat out missing them. Not because these are malicious, evil, bad dudes, and sometimes there are, don't get me wrong, but often these things are missed and mishandled because of good intentions, but lack of training, lack of understanding, lack of knowledge. When Sarah talked about nakedness, that was an outcry. That was a piecemeal disclosure, giving something, taking something that this bishop had given her about covering her nakedness and not seeing her nakedness, and giving him something, a small disclosure, hoping that he'd ask, well, tell me more about that, or something like that. So when we talk about these bishop interviews, there certainly is a worthwhile conversation to be talking about when the offender is the bishop, and that they're using these interviews to actually commit abuse. And that certainly happens and has happened. And that's a problem and an issue that needs to be addressed, but I want to put a pin on that for a second and instead talk about the impact on a victim when they're coming to a bishop and they're giving piecemeal disclosures that are just being missed because they aren't getting the training that they need. But this isn't unique to clergy. I go around talking to teachers, and I go around talking to physicians, and I go around talking to other mandatory reporters. And absent a kid saying, like they say on South Park, so-and-so molested me, they don't get it. But kids don't do that. That's kind of the joke of the South Park bit, is these are false accusations that these kids are doing in the show. Let's just say that they molested me, using wrong terminology, that's what most mandatory reporters are relying on or expecting before they report. They're looking for a purposeful disclosure, and they act as if that's the only way they'll know or can report abuse. And that's one way. But in not understanding the process of victimology and the way that victims are burdened by the realities of what they deal with, and not understanding those burdens and seeing how they're manifest through this process of victimization, they're failing our kids right and left. Because they're just not equipped to even recognize when a kid's telling them, I'm being molested. Because that's what Sarah did. And that's what Rob did in 2009 to these bishops. If you're listening to the kids, and we talked about that a couple weeks ago, right? Listen to our kids. They tell us so much. But we don't just have to listen to our kids. We can listen to our mandatory reporters and the bishops and the church to demonstrate they just have no idea what they're doing when it comes to sexual abuse and reporting of sexual abuse. All right, so let's get into mandatory reporting. So I'm going to come back to this in a second. I'm going to demonstrate why these bishops are not just, so these bishops are absolutely failing our kids, but the church is failing their own bishops by not giving them the tools to recognize these things, to be asked to be in such a tough position and do such a tough job but not be given the tools to deal with it. To put these bishops in an interview where they are effectively calling for disclosures and not arming them with the tools in order to actually help these kids. We're going to talk about that in a minute. Before, let's talk about mandatory reporting. You know, there's been a lot of conversation about these new cases that have come through, and they're jarring, really. And it's been interesting to watch, but from my perspective, I've keep coming back to Rob's case. And I come back to Rob's case because we don't have to look at new cases and these cases that have come in with very limited information. We can look at Rob's case. And because I had a great detective, we have recordings of bishops. We have recordings of other leaders and other people who are involved in church policy. We have a full-blown police report. We know what happened. So Rob's case is a perfect case study to demonstrate where the problems, to demonstrate the process of victimization, how victims behave, how offenders behave, and how institutions and systems fail victims again and again and again. We don't have to guess. We have the case study. So one of the things that I want to do is go through this case study, go through Rob's case, because we have audio recordings of bishops who tell us what we've known for a long, long time. So before we get into that, I want to talk about mandatory reporters, and specifically clergy, and specifically as it relates to the Mormon Church. Clergy members are mandatory reporters, except when they receive the information in either a confessional or confidential setting, okay? It all depends on the state you're in. There are some states out there, Texas, clergy are mandatory reporters, and there are no exceptions whatsoever. Okay? So, if a bishop in Texas gets a report about abuse, they have to report it to police. In Utah, my understanding, and I don't practice in Utah, so I'm doing my best to get this right. I'm happy to have anybody correct me on this. In Utah, my understanding is that there is a confidential communication exception, meaning if a member of the congregation is talking to the bishop and the institution understands that that is to be confidential, they don't report. In Arizona, it's kind of complicated, but my analysis is, and there's some people who disagree, is that it's a confessional setting. It's a little different than just a confessional setting, not like a confidential setting, because in Arizona it says that the communication has to be enjoined in discipline, part of discipline. I read that to say that if the offender comes in and says, I've been doing this, that's an exception. That means they do not report, will not report. They may encourage that person to report, but they will not be reporting. If a victim comes in and says, this has happened, my analysis is in Arizona, they must report. Because that's not a confessional. That's merely a confidential communication between this member of the congregation and the bishop. Are the distinctions clear? Anyone clarification on that? These are critical things to understand. And they're critical things to understand because I've happened to have fairly involved conversations with attorneys at Curtin McConkie. What's up, Randy Austin? And one of the things they'll say is, and they believe this, intently. If they don't report, and if bishops aren't forced to report, that actually facilitates victims coming forward and disclosing. That's their philosophy, that's their theory. But what I tell them is, the problem is every case we know, when these victims report, you're not reporting. Because you don't understand the process of victimization. And if you don't understand the process of victimization, and you don't understand things like piecemeal disclosure and delayed disclosure and recantation, and the burdens that these kids experience, you're not listening. So it doesn't really matter. Because again, you're only talking about the cases where there's a purposeful disclosure, the least likely one, the least common type of disclosure. So you're missing these other disclosures where the kids are prompted. They don't realize that they're prompting this disclosure. But that's a real quick summary of the law as it relates to the clergy exception. So, anyway, that's the backdrop for mandatory. Any questions on that?
I actually do.
Yeah, please.
Do you know if in all states, if a victim comes to a clergyman, they're able to disclose that?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, because you said that in the state of Arizona, if the abuser were to come to clergy, then that would be considered confidential.
That's my analysis, yeah.
Okay, and then you said for the victim, if they were to go to clergy and disclose the abuser, is that still confidential?
Well, it's a good question. And it does make sense. I get your question. And here again, not at all. Again, it comes down to... Yeah, the question is if a victim comes forward, that would not be a confessional, that would be a confidential communication, and so a clergy member in Arizona would have to report. Did I get your question right? But let's tease that out a little bit, because it's not that clear cut. Because who's interpreting whether or not it's a confessional or a confidential communication? Who determines that? The bishop gets to decide. So, let's go to Rob's case. We don't have to guess. We have a case study to know. And see if I can get here quickly. Okay. So he was interviewed. The bishop in this case was interviewed about this. And he said, well, I appreciated his honesty, talking about the time when this kid reported the abuse. I appreciated his honesty because that's part of the, you know, the bishop's job. You want to make sure they don't just leave anything where they'll stew over it and it'll bother them and they'll come back in, you know, kind of like not a complete confession, I guess is the best way to describe it. So right now, where's this bishop's head at? Does he see this as a confession or as a report by a victim?
Confession.
Confession. He says it himself. Right? Here again, lack of training, lack of understanding. If a bishop thinks that the only way abuse happens is stranger danger and doesn't understand how loved ones engage, groom, assault, and conceal the abuse from these kids, they only see abuse in one way that many of us see often. If it's not stranger danger, it's not abuse, it's a confessional. Because the same thing that that kid feels, that shared responsibility, the blame that they put on themselves, the bishop is putting on them as well. And that's what the bishop in this case clearly did. I mean, I guess, he's clarifying, he's thinking through it. I guess the victim's kind of thing would be technically a confession if he's telling you what he did. I mean, it is wrong. But then again, I kind of see it as that he was kind of duped. Do you know what I mean? I mean, you probably met the victim, and he's, you know, he's a big kid. He's charismatic. You know, could he have stopped this? I would say probably yes. We don't have to guess what the problem is here, guys. This is the one we know about. This is the one who submitted to an interview. Is this an anomaly, do you think? Again, I want to give this bishop a little bit of credit. It's not his fault. This bishop cared about this kid. He cared about this family. This bishop is a victim of the system and the institution he was thrown into as well. He failed this kid. But he was failed by not giving the tools to do the job he's forced to do. To conduct an interview with a kid that is going to call for disclosure or be in a position where a kid may come to them and say, Bishop, you're the only person that I can tell. I can't tell my mom. I can't tell my dad. I can't tell anybody, but I have you. And when they come forward and tell the bishops and give a piecemeal disclosure or do like Rob did, the reaction they get is, you should read. Read your scriptures and pray. So, the same bishop acknowledges there are real problems if abuse of a minor gets, quote, swept under the rug. He assumes that the other bishop, the offender's bishop, called legal, and that was sufficient because, quote, he made somebody aware of it. This bishop who received the information from another bishop, the offender's bishop, before this kid ever went and talked to him, assumed it was already taken care of, so he did nothing. So first you have to know that what you're talking about is a disclosure, is abuse. And if you don't even understand what abuse looks like, it makes sense that you're just going to call this a confession. And so even if they would otherwise be legally obligated to, who decides? He does. The church does. And there's been a lot of cases where the church comes in and says, no, this is part of the confessional. In this case, because of the church handbook of instructions, remember, we have the offender's bishop, clearly a confession, right? Under their policies, under the church handbook of instructions, calls the victim's bishop, and now brings that bishop's the victim's bishop as part of the confessional that the offender made. So even if that bishop understood that this was abuse and this was a victim reporting, he was still part of the confession of the offender. when that bishop notified him as part of the confession. Problem. It's a problem. So, what did the church say? Because the church chose to make a statement in this case. They didn't have to. They didn't have to. But they chose to make a statement on Rob's case. And here's what they said. Because they were asked about the 2009 meeting. And here's what they said. Local church leaders did not become aware of any credible information about this sexual relationship until October 2010. Within a very short time, these leaders were instrumental in getting the matter reported to law enforcement authorities. I don't use this term lightly. That is a lie. The leaders had nothing to do with the report to law enforcement. After waiting many days, after this kid went to his bishop and nothing was done, the kid's father went to another friend who happened to be a law enforcement officer, and that law enforcement officer got it reported to the right agency. So why they said that, I don't know. But they chose to say that. But that's not the worst part. The worst part is this. The meeting that took place in October 2009 was not held to discuss allegations of sexual abuse. I say that again. The meeting that took place in October 2009 was not held to discuss allegations of sexual abuse. The victim's family asked for the meeting to discuss their concerns about improper gifts and influence. In their statement, the church said, "We didn't know sexual abuse was going on. The only thing we were there to talk about in 2009 was the manner in which she was engaging and grooming this kid as part of the sexual abuse. But we learned nothing about sexual abuse. Doing anything more than this case study to see where the problem with the church's policy is. The church's policy is flawed because they don't understand the fundamentals of sexual abuse, and they tell you that when they speak to the press. The meeting that took place in October 2009 was not held to discuss allegations of sexual abuse. The victim's family asked for the meeting to discuss their concerns about improper gifts and influence." The church is telling you exactly what they don't know. How can we hope that they will respond correctly to sexual abuse when they just don't know what it is? This is where I start getting worked up. They just don't know what it is. So, I have talked to Randy Austin and Curtin McConkie on a number of occasions. People that I've worked with in the past have talked to Curtin McConkie, Randy Austin on a number of occasions. This isn't a new situation. The Joseph Bishop case isn't a new situation. We don't have to guess where the problems are, we know. Those of us who've been in this field have known for a long, long time because we have cases like this. We've heard the audio, we've listened to what they think, we listen to what they say, and we believe them. We believe the church when they say that meeting had nothing to do with sexual abuse. It only had to do with improper gifts and influence. Thank you for revealing your abject ignorance on the topic. So I've talked to these people. I've talked to bishops. And what I've learned, what I feel very strong about, is most bishops want these tools. They want to help these kids. They want to help these kids. Most of them want to report. And they're instructed not to by church council. So, I'm going to use this case, Rob's case, as a way to train mandatory reporters. way to train parents, teachers, physicians, counselors, other people who might be interested in the process of victimization and the burdens that kids experience. And I'm going to do this for clergy and for those good bishops out there that have good intentions to help their kids. Because if the church won't train them, I will. If the church won't, I will. For Sarah, for Rob, and all my kids. So that's the very beginning of the problem with the interview. The problem with the setup, the style, the approach, and the topics that are being covered. There are calls for disclosure by your local insurance salesman. So, that's what I want to do ongoing, is I want to take Rob's case and I want to break it down, as I've done many, many, many times, because we don't have to guess. We have all the information that we need here to be able to understand what the process of victimization looks like, what disclosures are like, and why victims behave the way they do, why offenders behave the way they do, and why the church and other institutions and mandatory reporters behave the way they do. We don't have to guess. And this doesn't have to be the only case study. I was speaking to some people about this, and people were talking about, well, if you don't have cases that have strong evidence, it's really tough to know what happened. And I say that's not true. They're all case studies. And we have this case study of Rob's, but there are other case studies out there. And people are providing their own case studies by explaining what they experienced, the way they were failed, the way they weren't listened to. So I'd ask for case studies. If people want to be listened to, I hear you. I will listen to you and explain what the real world of abuse looks like. So people will send me their case studies and want to talk about their experience to give their voice, to join the voice amongst all these victims. Not to stamp out abuse, because that's just not going to happen. But we can reduce the trauma. We can reduce the impact on these victims. We can bring victims out sooner and give them a place of love and safety when they do disclose. One of the things we'll talk about is the way that information, way disclosure should be received and can be received. The way they're being received by these ecclesiastical leaders are just not helpful. It's why victims feel and are ignored and dismissed. They're not being heard because these bishops don't have the tools to listen. So that was about 45 minutes. We're going to take this case study. It's dense. There's a lot of stuff in there. Because, like good Mormons, the offender kept a journal. The offender wrote letters. And I had a prolific detective that recorded everything. So we don't have to guess. We know. This is every case. This is every victim. This is every offender. All we have to do is listen to what the victim says, listen to what the offender says, listen to what these bishops say and what the institution says, to see just how broken the system is and just how failed these kids are. So we can stop failing them just a little bit. Questions.
Now that all these cases have come to light, has the church discussed perhaps better train these bishops on these issues, or is it just kind of
swept under the rug? I don't know. So the question was, since these other cases have come out recently, has the church had a conversation about changing policies? Why not? I don't know. I'm not privy to that. I hope so, but I rather than as I've been getting involved in this debate, in this discussion, the thing that I think is not talked about is what I'm talking about, which is how much training these bishops really need to have if they're going to help these kids that come forward. So, I mean, I think there are other policies we could talk about, and I do have recommendations for what the church should do, what they must do in some cases, but it starts with giving them bona fide training on the process of victimization. So they understand things like selection, engagement, grooming, concealment, shared responsibility, delayed disclosure, piecemeal disclosure. These concepts that get thrown around, right, in various fields have meaning because consider the impact on the victim. So I don't know if they're changing their policies. I hope with a little bit more information, even if they don't change their policies, the bishops that might learn about this stuff, the parents that might learn about this stuff, and whomever might learn about this stuff will be better equipped to help these kids. And in getting this information out there, my hope is that these victims will hear their story, will feel that they've been and know that they've been heard, and they will be heard and be listened to. And as they hear their story manifesting in other people's, their case study manifested in other people's case study, that they'll feel a measure of healing so they can understand why they reacted the way they did, why they behaved the way they did, and why there's no reason to feel shame and blame and that shared responsibility. And I hope that that'll provide at least a beginnings or a measure of healing, or at least a step towards healing. Please.
The system that they have in place as far as delivering you from one archbishop to another archbishop, doesn't that lie within the church? It's not kind of like a way to filter news?
Well, I think it's a good question. The question is the system that allows one bishop to contact another bishop to inform them of the incident, it's a way of sharing news. There are certainly reasons why that makes sense. Right? It would certainly make sense that you would want another bishop who's responsible for a member of their congregation to be aware of something serious that kid's going through. Right? But my question is, in that situation, then why nothing was done in that case? All that happened is this information went into this vacuum and no intervention was done. Go ahead.
It's under the same church, right? They're part of the same institution.
Yeah.
So isn't that a way to shield the institution from, bad news, bad publicity?
Issues of, is it meant to shield from bad publicity and those things? That certainly may have the effect, and there may be motivations behind that, possibly. I don't know. I guess some of the motivations as to why abuse isn't being reported is less critical to me or less important than the fact that it's happening. Because too often we go to malicious intent. This is to cover up abuse. And maybe it is. But what I've experienced is often well-intentioned negligence is just as damaging to those kids as a malicious cover-up. So I'm because of that, I'm less concerned for the reasons why abuse isn't reported and victims don't get intervention that they could use, and the motivations behind it, than the fact that it is absolutely happening. And I think it's happening for a myriad of different reasons and motivations, because people are so complex and people's experiences and perceptions vary so much. So I think it's hard to take one scenario and establish motivations there. But rather, we can look at a case and say, here's absolutely where the system breaks down. And here's some protections that can be in place to mitigate and lessen the instances where there's so many problems. Is that responsive to your question? Thank you for the question. It's a really good one. I want to tell you a story about another one of my kids. And this is Emma. And Emma's mom came to my office a couple years ago. I got a call and was asked if I could come out and say, you know, somebody was here to see me. It is like anyone, you hate being sprung on that. I don't like, you know, someone knocking on my door unexpected. So I go out there and I see Emma's mom. And Emma's mom says, do you even remember me? And I said, yes, of course I remember you. It's so good to see you. Thank you for stopping by. And she said, you know, I was just driving through. I wanted to pull over, and I wanted to see if I could give you a hug. Hug? Heck yeah, come here. It was one of the nicest hugs I ever got. And it really touched me. And I asked her, how's Emma doing? And Emma's doing great. Emma's found a voice. Emma's talking comfortably about her experience. She's gotten a little older. She's recognized some things that she went through, and she's processing it very well. She's playing volleyball. She sings in the choir at school. She has good days and bad days, but the good days are becoming more frequent, and the bad days are happening less and less and less. I don't see these kids as broken. I don't see them as flawed. I see them as complicated humans that were burdened beyond what they should have had to deal with. And so many of them are thriving despite it. And I have confidence in these kids. This is heavy stuff. The only way I know how to cleanse the palate is through some music. So if you will indulge me, I've asked my daughter to sing a song that, just to cleanse the palate, man, and may give us a little bit of hope. And to me, it's been a song that just embodies my kids. So many of my kids. So, if you'll let me, Dylan. 2 weeks from now, I do. 2 weeks from now, we're going to continue on, and we're going to start with the case study, Rob's case study. I will likely have other professionals, hopefully the detective that was involved, will come in and talk about his experience as well, and kind of his perspective on things. And we're going to just dig into this and start going through the process of victimization and the other issues that are here that exist in this case that highlight the system problems of the church, the policies and practices that exist that have problems, and how understanding of the process of victimization and what victims go through can help, I think, all of us who are looking to help their kids. So 2 weeks from now, what? You're connected?
Yeah.
All right. Sure, you can put it right up here. You ready to go? She's very shy, so.
Maybe there's a reason to
out. So let the sun come streaming in, cause you'll reach up and you'll rise again. If you only look around, you will be found.
Hillary.
Matthew, Ryan,
Carol,
Keith,
Ashley.
And I like to play bingo online while listening to Infants on Thrones.
You can comment on this episode on the website, infantsonthrones.com.
And if you really like what you hear, give the Quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes.
I did.
Anyone for the closing prayer?
Thank you for listening to Infants on Thrones.